and on MOOC data analysis, open source code for open education. This session will be streamed to the online conference participants. Our presenters today are Ted Polly from Indiana University at Bloomington, who's a research and editorial assistant there, and Abraham Murray, senior product manager at Google. And of course, please remember after this session to use the online evaluation tool to submit your evaluations. Thank you.
Hi, thank you all for joining us here and in the online world as well. As I was introduced, my name is Ted Polly. I'm a research and editorial assistant at the Cyber Infrastructure for Network Science Center at Indiana University in Bloomington.
Thank you, Ted. Hi, everybody, and a big welcome to the online audience. My name is Abe Murray, and I lead the product management team in Google Research, where I've spent much of the last year focused on our education efforts. And to those folks listening online, I'm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there's a lot of Google in California, so I'm well aware of being on the other side of the video camera. And thank you all for being here locally. So I'm going to start by giving a brief overview of the online education space. And I'm going to talk about how open source platforms are a key piece of this equation. And then I'm going to hand the talk off to Ted, who's going to show you what they've actually accomplished at Indiana University using our open source MOOC platform, and it's very exciting, and I think you'll all enjoy it. 6 million students. Over 6 million students took at least one online course in the fall of 2010. These were from for-profit online universities or at, you know, traditional public or private universities. These represented online degree and certificate programs. These students are growing at a 10% growth rate, which is quite phenomenal when you compare it to the growth rate of traditional education, which is growing at about 2% a year. But these figures, again, are from 2010, so this isn't news, and all of you in this audience know that. You know, so what's different today, and why are we here? And we're here because education is changing, right? In the year that I've been working on this, I've rarely seen the world move so fast. And I come from the technology scene where we expect the world to move fast. It's been a phenomenal year. Massive open online courses, MOOCs, have changed how people think about and are talking about online education. And some of you who have been working in this space since before all the media figured it out might feel like, well, we've been getting there. But people are paying attention in a new way. And I think it is because of what's happening with MOOCs. Within the first year of these MOOC platforms being out on the scene, over 2 million students have registered for these new online courses. You know, go back to 6 million. That's a third of the demand for existing online education is jumping in on MOOCs. Coursera, edX, Udacity, these are perhaps the best known examples and providers of MOOCs, and there are many more out there. We're approaching easily 1,000 top quality courses from institutions around the world being delivered to the world as MOOCs at this point. You know, that's pretty incredible. A year and change on in. This is an exciting time for education. That's why we're here, right? In particular, this is an exciting time for experiments. And we at Google are excited to be contributing to these through our own open source software, which we've contributed to the world, through our own courses, which we've developed and delivered to the world, and through supporting our partners, such as Indiana University, in their own courses and experiments. You know, we're very glad that we're able to participate in building an open learning ecosystem. You know, where all educators are able to jump in, teach, and learn as they bring education to the world at scale, or as they reimagine education in their existing classrooms. Google's supporting innovation in this space. You know, we believe that open source platforms are a key component in this ecosystem. Google's been involved in education for quite some time, including online education. When Peter Norvig, who's at Google, taught the artificial intelligence class at Stanford that did go online to the world and had 160,000 students register from around the world, and they found that some of their best students were from elsewhere, not locally at Stanford, he recognized that to be one of the 10-time opportunities that our CEO Larry Page talks about, an opportunity to change the world by an order of magnitude, stepping beyond the traditional incremental innovation. But we also realized that these first steps were basic. They were little more than televising radio. We'd taken the lecture online, and we'd improved it a bit, but there was a lot more to do. And we knew that no single organization could come up with all the answers today. You know? Nobody can solve all the problems by themselves. We also knew that Google's unique position with its infrastructure and services that scale, such as a Google Docs, Google Drive, Hangouts, our cloud platform, you know, Google Plus, these are a key part of the answers here. So we committed to showing the world what is possible by delivering an open source MOOC platform. We've been in good company. Many others out there share our vision and our motivations. Last year, Stanford released Class2Go, its own open source MOOC platform. And around the same time, we released Course Builder, which Ted will speak to you today about their experiences using it. And just this past summer, edX released their platform as OpenEdX, so anybody can build and use that same platform. As of this September, we're all working together. All of these open source participants have joined with OpenEdX, and I'll speak to that later today. For now, though, I'd like to step back and focus on what is possible using an open source MOOC platform. From our perspective, it is the flexibility and accessibility of these platforms that excite us. Educators are able to maintain direct relationships with their students while making changes to the course experience to meet the unique needs of their classes and their schools. Just as the open web allowed many people, you know, to expand the possibilities of what a website could be, from simple static web pages to the universe of incredible web applications and experiences that exist today, so too can an open education platform, an ecosystem, expand the possibilities of how online courses are taught and how people learn online. We are very grateful to innovative educators, such as Ted and his colleagues at Indiana University, who are showing all of us what is possible and inspiring us to keep pushing ahead. So, Ted?
Thank you, Abe, for that nice introduction. Today I'm going to sort of walk you through our experience using Google Course Builder, building a MOOC, launching it to the students, and walk you through the course, what it looks like, and how the students experienced the course. So in September of 2012, Indiana University began exploring the use of MOOCs as an alternative to reach wider audience as part of the IU Online Initiative. In October of that year, Dr. Borner, my boss, was approached about taking a course she taught on information visualization in the School of Library and Information Science and adapting that to a MOOC. In November, we worked really closely with the Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning at Indiana University, and they helped us establish the MOOC, set up Course Builder, and gave us instructional support as well. And then the course went live in January 2013. So basically October to January, a pretty short timeline, we were able to get up and running with Google Course Builder and present our MOOC. So we had several goals in mind for the MOOC. First, we wanted to scale Dr. Borner's information visualization class to anyone who wanted to take it around the world. We wanted to make it available to all. We wanted to survey state-of-the-art in information visualization and design. We wanted to introduce students to algorithms that allowed them to identify patterns and trends in raw data and then display these visually. And then we wanted to give them the theoretical foundation with which they could use to effectively interpret visualizations that they encountered in the wild. And then in addition to the theoretical foundation, we wanted to give them the practical skills necessary to create their own unique and insightful visualizations, you know, with data from their own lives or with their research data. And then we wanted to create a highly collaborative environment that students could work with each other and work with real-world clients on actual information visualization projects. So a pretty big list of things that we wanted to accomplish. During the initial planning phases of the course, Google Course Builder was suggested to us as a platform that we might want to consider when hosting our course. And after doing some research, we decided that Google Course Builder was, in fact, the right platform for us. And for three reasons, the first being that it's open source. It aligned well with our mission and commitment to open source programs. And then it's highly flexible. We weren't constrained by a service in terms of how we presented our information to students. And then finally, it scaled well to our needs. We weren't expecting 10,000 or so students in our first MOOC. We were hoping for about 2,000. So for us, it seemed like Google Course Builder, given the timeline that we had, would be the best option. In addition to these goals, we had some other things that we wanted to accomplish. We wanted to mirror Dr. Borner's physical class as much as possible. So we wanted to create an experience for students online that was as authentic to the actual information visualization class offered at Indiana University. And a large part of this involved working with real-world clients. So in Dr. Borner's physical class, students are required to work with actual clients on information visualization projects, and we decided that the MOOC students would be required to do that as well. And then finally, we wanted a small sample of students at Indiana University to take the course. So we had Dr. Borner's students in her class in the spring of 2013 actually take the MOOC as it went live. So we had a hybrid style. We had some face-to-face learners engaging with the material, and then we also had the MOOC ecosystem, or all the MOOC students engaging with the material as well, and then the interaction between the two. So the instructors for the course, Dr. Cadi Borner is the main instructor. She taught the theoretical sessions. She is a professor of information science at the School of Informatics and Computing in the Department of Information and Library Science at Indiana University. Myself, I taught the hands-on sections, so I taught students how to apply what they learned in the theoretical portion of the course and actually create visualizations. And then Scott Weingart, who is a PhD student, served as an assistant instructor both in Dr. Borner's physical class and in the MOOC as well. So the schedule for the course, we went live on January 22nd, 2013. During the first week, we looked at the workflow design and visualization framework. So we taught students the process by which they develop visualizations. Week two, we looked at temporal data. So we analyzed how data evolve over time and how best to visually represent this. Week three, we looked at geospatial data. So we plotted data on geographic maps. In week four, we looked at topical data. So we did topical analysis, identifying themes from text. And then there was a midterm. In week five, we looked at hierarchical data, visualizing those as trees. And then in week six, we looked at networks. So we did some social network analysis. We looked at citation networks, co-authorship networks, and how best to visualize those. And then we concluded with a brief discussion on dynamic visualizations and how to deploy visualizations to the web. There was a final exam on March 10th, and then a week later, the final projects were due. So each unit in the MOOC was structured in the same way. There was the theoretical section, which consisted of usually 3 to 4 videos on YouTube, and those were lectures that Dr. Borner gave, and then there were slides to accompany those. And then in addition to the lectures and slides, there was a self-assessment for each unit. And this offered one more opportunity for students to engage with the material and to hopefully start to apply what they're learning in the theoretical section. And then the hands-on portion of the unit consisted of video tutorials using the different tools that we were teaching in the course. So I taught students how to apply what they learned in the theory section and walk them through the process of creating a visualization, going from the raw data, putting it in the tool, analyzing it, extracting whatever type of visualization we were working with, and then presenting it in a way that was visually pleasing. In addition to these videos, there was a wiki link, so our extensive online documentation was provided to students so that they could, in addition to the videos, start to read through that material and learn how to create visualizations. And then there were homework assignments. So the homework assignments were also not graded. They were open-ended prompts that encourage students to go find their own data and start to create their own visualizations, and usually they aligned well with a workflow that was covered in the hands-on section that week. So the tools taught in the course. The main tool is the Science of Science tool, and it's an open source information visualization program developed at the center where I work. It supports the visualization and analysis of temporal, geospatial, topical, and network data, so it aligned closely with what we were teaching in the course, and since we develop it in-house, we know it pretty well, and it was easy to teach to students. In addition to that, we taught Gephi, which is a program that some of you might be familiar with. We used Gephi primarily to teach students about dynamic visualizations and how to export visualizations to the web. Gephi makes this really easy. It's also an open source program as well. And then finally, in a section, we taught PyEC. PyEC is a well-known graph visualization and analysis program. It's really popular in the social sciences, so we felt it warranted mentioning in the MOOC, and we taught a session on how to use PyEC. So the clients. This is the thing that I think distinguishes our MOOC from most others that I've seen. We had 15 real-world clients working on really interesting visualization projects, and they agreed to make their data available to students to sort of crowdsource ideas for how to effectively solve and represent the data that they were working with. So we asked the students in the MOOC to form groups of 4 to 5 to work with these clients on these projects. And in the end, we had about 13 different student projects for 9 different clients. So we didn't assign groups to clients. We didn't assign students to groups. We simply provided the mechanisms for them to create groups and to contact clients and start to work on these projects. So we do have a few clients who didn't see any results for their projects, and they're interested in returning to next year's MOOC, which I'll talk about later. So here are some of the results from the client projects. And I don't know if you can see these too well, but I was really impressed with a lot of the student work. In particular, the one in the upper left-hand corner, visualizing Hive NYC. I think this is a great example of one visualization that encapsulates really complex data and represents it across a variety of different visualization types. So you can see there's some geospatial visualization going on, some network visualization, and the display of how these data change over time. So I can go into that a little more detail at the end if you have some questions about it. So the MOOC grading. The final grades were based on the midterm, which was weighted 30%, the final, which was weighted 40%, and the client project, which was weighted 30%. For students who received more than 80% of all available points, they were awarded a letter of accomplishment and then also a Mozilla badge, which they could add to their LinkedIn profile or their online CV. So we used the main tools we used to create this active and learning environment for students. As I mentioned before, Google Course Builder. We used Google Course Builder, the very first version, 1.0. We basically left it as it was. We implemented some aesthetic changes to match CNS branding. We sought to create kind of a unique feel for students, but by and large, it was, run out of the box. We also developed a Drupal forum, and this was to create one place to facilitate all the student interaction. So in the Drupal forum, students could communicate with each other, they could communicate with clients, they created profiles and listed their areas of expertise, and then they were able to form these groups, communicate with their groups through private messaging. We had forums for each client, so once students identified a client project on which they would like to work, they could communicate closely with the client. And then we hosted a lot of the client data, so we made the data available through the forum as well. The last two pieces of the puzzle, in addition to Course Builder and the Drupal forum that we created, we created a hashtag IVMOOC on Twitter, and we really encouraged students to use that to share insight, to share links to visualizations they found meaningful, to share their own work, to comment on other students' work. So it was surprisingly active, and a lot of students really engaged with us and engaged with each other via Twitter. And then Flickr, we encouraged students and required for the homework assignments that all the resulting visualizations be posted on Flickr and tagged with Ivy MOOC, so you can actually go and search Ivy MOOC and see all the results of the student homework and their final projects. And it's really interesting. I would encourage you to do so if you are at all interested. A lot of really impressive visualizations. So I'm going to give you a quick course tour. Oops. So here is the this is the interface here. This is what students see once they're logged in. You can see the schedule up here. We had a pre-questionnaire and a post-questionnaire just to collect data about the students. Each week, we made each week available at Sunday night at 11:59 p.m. So students were able to get the material and look at it that way. We had an announcements page. This allowed us to communicate basic course announcements with the students. And then the forum, which I mentioned earlier. So here we have the list of the different topics. So you can see we have some basic site questions, coursework, and then within each forum, students had the ability to vote up questions, and this was one of the ways that as instructors we really tried to provide feedback to the students. You know, as MOOCs scale, you can only provide so much feedback as an instructor, and we felt that that was one of the best ways to engage students and to maintain this collaborative learning environment was to provide feedback to students. So we had the ability to vote up questions, and this allowed us to sort of sift through all the questions that were coming in as instructors and pick out the ones where students were having the most problems. You know, where are they having trouble with the tools? Where are they having trouble, you know, with the concepts, and respond to those questions effectively and hopefully reach more students as a result. And then if you look at the profiles here, this is Abe's profile. So you can see that if we look down, we have a bio, and Abe didn't do so, but you can identify areas of expertise. So this allowed students to search out others. You know, say I'm a data miner, but I'm looking for a designer to work in my group on my project. I can search all of the students. Let me go to the students tab. I can search all of the students to identify the all the designers. And then I can start to communicate with people who identified themselves as designers and see, hey, you know, I need a designer for my group. Would you be willing to work on this project with me? So that's kind of how we tried to create a really active and collaborative environment for the students. Okay. So the analysis. Being information visualization experts, a lot of our analysis includes visualization, so hopefully these will be interesting to you. We had 1,780 students take the course from 93 different countries. The majority of students came from the United States, although it was followed closely by India, the United Kingdom, Canada, and the Netherlands. 253 students didn't identify a location. But the vast majority of them came from the United States in our experience. In total, we had 1,517 who registered in time to successfully complete the course. So that is, they registered before the midterm, had time to synthesize the material, take the midterm, and then continue with the course. So of those 1,500 or so, we had 58 students who earned a letter of accomplishment and a badge. So you know, this is pretty well in line with what most MOOCs experience, about a 10% completion rate. In terms of student demographics, the vast majority of the students came from the 21 to 30, 31 to 40 age group. A lot of them were working in higher education or had higher education, so working on or had received graduate degrees. We had a few high school students or those who identified themselves as high school students. And then in terms of profession, you can see the vast majority identified themselves as other. Based on my experience in working with the students and seeing how they identify their areas of expertise, I can tell you that The vast majority of them were working in higher education in some capacity, either as staff, working as instructional designers themselves, working as IT professionals, or we have a lot of librarians taking the course as well. So these are the communication networks. And we created these. We collected data about the students and the student activities on Drupal and Course Builder, and collected the activity from Twitter as well. So these are the communication networks of all the students who either participated in the group work or who were active on Twitter. So each node in this network is a student, and the students who are connected by the gray edges represent the student groups working on the projects. So you can see some clusters of those. And then the directed orange edges represent the communication on Twitter, so directed tweets either answering questions or asking questions of others on Twitter. And what's really interesting, I think, about these networks, you'll notice that the vast majority of the groups had at least one person active on Twitter, and they weren't communicating, they weren't using Twitter to communicate so much within the groups, but they were using it to communicate across the groups or with other students in the course. Then they were relying on other methods to communicate with their group members, either the forum or email. A lot of them set up Skype meetings to do their work or Google Hangouts to do their work on the group projects. The nodes here are colored by the level of experience. It's kind of hard to see on the slide, but gray has no response given. That yellow color is very low experience with information visualization, going all the way up to that red color, which is a lot of experience with information visualization prior to the course. And you'll notice that most of the students working in the groups didn't have a lot of experience with information visualization prior to the course, but there were a few who did and were active on Twitter. A couple of those are the instructors communicating with students, but a few of the others are faculty members who teach similar courses or who are interested and kind of just logged in to see what the MOOC was all about and happened to also be active on Twitter. And then this is the same network, but the nodes this time are colored based on how students identified themselves. And I think what's particularly interesting about this network, you don't see a lot of homogeneity in terms of the expertise within the group. So like I said earlier, you don't have all data miners working in one group. You have a data miner, a designer, and maybe a librarian working together. So, and this was really evident in the final projects, the diverse amount of experience brought to bear on solving these problems was really interesting to see. And then this is an analysis of the content usage of the course. So to monitor content usage, we looked at the total views of YouTube videos, and we also use the Tin Can API to track the amount of videos watched. This particular figure shows you the number of videos viewed throughout the course. So we start at the top with the first video and we move down, and you'll notice a precipitous decline in viewership. And again, that tends to align well with what most other MOOCs experience. A lot of people sign up, show initial interest, and then it wanes towards the end. We were not to be dissuaded by that. We are running the MOOC again in 2014. This time it will have a focus on the digital arts and humanities and also statistics. So it will still be information visualization, but there will be additional modules focusing on topic modeling for digital humanists. And then we are working with a faculty member in the statistics department at IU who is working with us to teach students how they can statistically verify what they're seeing. So I see a pattern in my visualization, but is this pattern statistically relevant, or is it just happened due to chance? This course will be taught by Scott Weingart, who was the assistant instructor for this past course, and we hope to launch it, I believe, early January, probably around the same time we did the last course, so January 20th or so. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Abe.
It's really fantastic to see the results of the IV MOOC. The visualizations that the students generated are beautiful, they're inspiring. To see a 10% completion ratio, we all look at that and think, let's get it higher, but that's actually quite high for a MOOC, and it's something we think a lot about and pay attention to when we run our own courses. I'll give a piece of anecdata. It's My wife actually took the Information Visualization MOOC, and she had a specific goal in mind, and once she'd accomplished it, she did not finish it. And so that's one of the things that we've been thinking about as we look at this data, is thinking people come to these, you know, free sources of education with different motivations, and so we need to understand that as we judge what do these completion rates mean. Anyhow, it's really great to see continued innovation and upcoming iterations of this. This is how we learn. It was great to see how the groups self-evolved to have, you know, a mixed set of folks working on them. Really fun to see that. As I mentioned earlier, Google's joined Stanford, Berkeley, MIT, and Harvard as a contributor to OpenEdX, and we're going to continue contributing to what's happening in this space. We've already contributed code to the project, and we're excited to do much more as we move forward. EdX is committed to making it easier for educators to easily create and publish a course using OpenEdX, their open source platform, and we're working with them to make this happen, you know, taking advantage of Google's infrastructure and scale, just as we did with Course Builder, where it was quite easy for, you know, Indiana University to pick up Course Builder and get up and running with our version one of the product, which, you know, thank you, you were on the bleeding edge. We've gone through six iterations since then, and it's really a phenomenal open source MOOC platform. You know, we're going to make OpenEdX be just that easy to use for all of you here. Continuing innovation. You know, beyond contributing to the basic platform, we're also contributing our own experiments and our own expertise. You know, we're working on the social experience of online learning. You know, we believe that that's a critical piece of it. We want to help students find each other, learn from each other, teach each other. We want the online experience socially to be as good as the offline experience was. And, you know, with a couple simple tools, a forum, it works. We'd like to make it even better, and we have a lot to contribute there. You know, we're also very interested in the concept of evergreen content. And I actually found it interesting that when Ted showed you the forum, one of the top posts was, "I registered too late for this course. When will you run it again? I want to take it." And, you know, that's something we care a lot about. We think that students should be able to take these online course materials anytime, you know, at their own pace. And there's a lot of hard work in there around ad hoc cohorts and helping people have a good experience, because learning from one another, you know, that social interactivity is part of what makes a course good. But at the same time, we shouldn't be bringing artificial scarcity to the online world. Part of what's interesting about technology and online content is that you can get it anywhere. And today that's actually not true of a lot of those 1,000 MOOCs that I spoke about earlier. So every time somebody wants to learn something and goes and tries to learn it and has to wait a couple of months, well, if you imagine what the fall-off rate is, you're missing many opportunities to educate people. We also want to ensure that all educators can use these platforms. You know, whether you are building and launching a MOOC in the sense of as many people as we can get to learn from this, or whether you want to say, what could a hybrid experience be in our classroom? How can we do something interesting and different, you know, making our existing courses better? And whether you're a traditional educator, higher ed or K-12, or you're an educator anywhere out there in the world and you have a message to teach, we want everybody to have the same experience, you know, the same opportunity to get their educational content out. As we work on these challenges, we'll be giving back the results of these to the community. First, by continuing to publish the code and the work that we do as open source code so that anybody can take it and use it, as Indiana University did. Second, by publishing our own courses and working with our partners as they publish future courses. And finally, by publishing the results of our learnings. As Ted gave a snapshot of what they learned, so too, we look into the results of the 5 MOOCs that we've launched and the more to come, the over 400,000 students that we've seen come in and learn from us directly. And indeed, at the Google booth tomorrow, Julia Wilkowski, one of our instructional designers, will be diving in a lot deeper on what we did learn from the courses we published to date. We'll be sharing this. In addition, we just launched an accessibility MOOC, which helps developers learn how to create accessible websites, websites that you can access if you're using a screen reader. And we're going to take the content of that course and make it available to the world under a Creative Commons license. Again, showing people how we did things, giving exemplars, helping people get started, making it easier to dive in with your own experiment. If I can leave you, you know, with just one thought today, it is this. These are still the early days of online education. You know, whether you're teaching at scale or experimenting with new hybrid models, we welcome you to join those of us who are learning and trying new things. You can get started easily using an open source MOOC platform. You can have your educators use web interfaces to easily create and publish courses to the web that will scale. And you can take those courses and change them. You can change them to meet your own needs because they're open source. And again, because they're open source and you control them, you continue to own your relationship with your students. It's not disintermediated by anybody else. You own the data. You have full control over what you're doing. It's very powerful. And we think this is important to the development of that open education ecosystem. And you can do it. So thank you, Ted, for sharing with us what you did with our version 1 code. We invite you all to use the most recent code to follow what's happening with OpenEdX and in this space. And I hope that a year from now, when we're all back here, there are many more experiments that you'll all have to talk about from your own institutions. Thank you. And thank you to everybody who contributed behind the scenes. So I think we have time for discussions, questions. And I'll remind folks, if you could walk up to the microphones for the benefit of those who are joining us remotely. In the front?
Yeah, on the demographics you did, and the first bar was 21 to 30, I think.
Yep.
I'm curious of those 21-year-olds, if you know how many of those were actually in college or had a college degree. Did you measure that?
We might have collected that data, and I'm not sure that I can answer that question in terms of how many were actually in college while they were taking the MOOC. My sense is, at least the students that I interacted with tended to be working professionals, but I know we did have a lot of graduate students as well. I think part of the reason we didn't have as many college students, the difficulty of the material was a little more akin to a graduate class. So I think a lot of younger students might have gotten a little frustrated by the material early on.
So it does confirm the fact, though, that it seems right now, anyway, all the data suggests the MOOCs are real popular with working adults and not our traditional 18-year-olds at this point anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
And second question, if I could do a follow-up, is you had 1,700 students in your first go around. How did you market? How did you get 1,700 students?
I'm
not looking for an IV class.
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have a lot of listservs associated with the center. Everyone who registered for either the Science of Science tool that we develop, and also the scholarly database, which is a service that we offer that aggregates government data and provides one interface to search different publicly available government data. We advertise to people registered for both of those services, so that was a huge pull-in. Dr. Borner is pretty active in the field and has a lot of active colleagues, so just communication with them, getting them to distribute. Then we did some advertising at the university, and Google also helped us out and did some advertising for us as well.
I have a question about Course Builder versus edX. You're now supporting both. What is the difference, and where are they going?
Sure, and sorry in the back, we'll get to you next. So the question is Course Builder and edX. So Google created and released Course Builder to the public, which is a very simple tool for, allows almost a non-technologist to easily get up and running and create and publish a course using a web interface. We continue to support that. It continues to be a great answer for many people for creating online courses. OpenEdX is a, that powers edX.org, and it's a fantastic piece of code. It runs a little bit differently, so it's not as easy for somebody who's not a technologist to take it today and get it running. But it has many other benefits and a fantastic team behind it at edX. That is the future that we're heading towards, and one of the things we'd like to do with it is to make it just as easy to use and experience. And when we get there, we will make it very easy to take the courses that have been developed on Course Builder and move them over readily. That's one of the benefits of doing this work in the open ecosystem, totally in the open, is we can have standards and we can, move content around quite easily. Again, you've got the full control of your data. So in the back?
Yeah, Michael Akison here from Drop Thought. I just recently left Stanford Graduate School of Business, where I designed Josh Rao's Finance of Retirement and Pensions MOOC. That's on the NovoEd platform. Just launched this week. There is, 300 plus MOOCs on Coursera. There's, 50 on the Canvas network. There's, so Desire to Learn has a new platform. Blackboard has a new platform, and so on. We're getting maybe approaching soon maybe 1,000 MOOC courses in the history of MOOCs. I think it's where do professors go to get information? Like, if they're going to use the open platform that Stanford and MIT and Harvard and Google now are supporting, that's the technology, but running a course is a socio-technological process. And so one thing, as leading the project team for the graduate school of business at Stanford, it kind of takes us almost a small army, in a sense, to really make one of these courses run well. There's so many things that you don't account for when you're dealing with tens of thousands of students. What would be your suggestion to where do professors go if they're going to use an open platform that's really kind of not really supported by the overall university that they're from? Where do they go to get the support, the best practices, what to do when, and what to look out for, and so forth? Where is that resource for faculty to, and the instructional teams that are supporting those faculty to do things?
Yep, excellent question. Congratulations on the MOOC. That's fun. I wish you a great experience. And it's exactly the right question is, how do you make this happen? And I think it's fantastic that we're in a world where you have many options, and we applaud all of the efforts going on. Indeed, Google is friends with almost everybody doing something in this space, and we love to see, the possibilities pushed forward. If you're thinking about open education platforms, there's a couple routes to go down, but generally at this point, you may need a local team to help you out. Google's been working closely with a number of partners, so you can always reach out on the communities that are built up around these tools, and that's generally the best place to start. Ted, I'd be curious what your experience was.
Yeah, so I think in terms of the instructional side of things, I'd be willing to wager that most large universities have instructional design teams working somewhere. We worked very closely with the Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning at IU. So I think reaching out to those groups on your campus, they can help tremendously. In this case, they helped us set up the instance of Course Builder and also provided a lot of instructional design support. What's the best way to design a course and to take an existing course, translate it into a MOOC, and those types of things. So chances are there's someone on your campus already who's thinking about these questions and has some pretty good answers. So.
And to follow up on that, when I say reach out to the community, we are the community. So when you reach out, we'll hear from you and we'll get back to you. And when somebody at a school is interested in doing something interesting here, we often wind up involved and helping out. And depending on where you go, the technology piece of it can actually be quite simple. And I think that's actually one of the really encouraging things here is that, and actually I think one of the reasons that we're talking about this now, I took an online course, and I won't admit how long ago, as part of my master's study, which was primarily on campus, but a couple online courses, and they were terrible experiences, right? And I won't say what system I used, but a good number of years ago, and what's changed since then is bandwidth, the services that live around these online courses. And I think that the technology piece of it, while there's a lot to do and a lot to improve, it's actually one of the simpler things, and you're absolutely correct that the hard work is in creating the course. And again, I think that's why the experimentation can start now, is that the technology exists. It's sufficient to enable the experiments to start. And the experiments are just that, finding out how do we take content online and teach it well. Any other questions?
I think a little bit follow up on the question when one of the previous person asked that how do you market it?
really the question popped up, how do you handle it then when all the crowd comes? So do you have some statistics that what was the effort? First of all, how many questions were asked, how much time the instructor had to spend on what part of the things for this particular course?
That's an excellent question. And I can't give you a very definite answer, but I can tell you it was a pretty significant amount of time. In terms of the development phase, we're a pretty small shop. There are about 10 of us, I believe, full-time that work for CNS, and some hourly programmers and designers and things. It took about 3 or 4 of us working full-time from about October to mid-December to get everything together in time for the course. And then once the course was launched, I spent a significant amount of my time interacting with students, making sure that they had access to client data, trying to provide feedback. When it came time for grading the final projects, Dr. Borner and Scott Weingart actually graded them by hand and provided the feedback. Grading the assessments and distributing those was difficult. So as our method as it was, you know, isn't scalable to 10,000 students, but given the number we had, it worked for the time, but it took a significant amount of our effort once the course was even launched to provide the level of feedback that I think students were hoping to get.
And I think that's where these experiments come in. We're very excited to see people find this out. If you stop by our Google booth when Julia's talking about what we've learned, we've thought a lot about that as well, and we can go into detail. Yes?
It's actually a follow-up from the previous point, which is to get you to talk a bit more about the assessment strategy, particularly for the end of course project. And sounds like hard work anyway.
So the assessment strategy for the end of the course, short of giving you sort of the criteria, which I'm not as familiar with, Dr. Borner basically graded them in a manner which she would grade her the students in her actual class. So she treated these client projects as you know, projects that would have been submitted physically. They were graded in terms of, you know, whether or not the student, the group of students applied different visualization criteria. So, you know, using the right coloring scheme for the graphic variable with which you're working, making sure that you're applying appropriate data mapping, things like that. Does that answer your question, or were you?
Partially, but I imagine that the assessment criteria are available online, are they?
Yes, so there was a list of project instructions, and then as the project as the students worked through their project, they had to meet deadlines by doing certain parts of the project by a certain time. So they had to clearly define a question within the first week that they were trying to answer, do a brief write-up on that. So by going through these different steps, that's how we evaluated the overall project.
So, and this comment will address both of the last questions is, again, the experiments need to happen. I think that when we talk about social learning, it was interesting to see the graph showing that some of the most connected people in the class were the most experienced with the content. And if I remember back to my own education, you know, there were classes where I was more of an authority and I brought along other of my classmates through mentoring, and the roles were reversed at times. And I think that helping figure out how we can have students chime in, whether it's from a previous cohort or just the stronger students, building up, you know, technologies that enable that will help with the scale question. And the way that we get there is we just start doing it and find out, you know, how to improve it a little bit at a time. Similarly, peer grading. So we actually launched a peer grading feature in Course Builder. EdX has one as well. You know, they're all first instances of this, and there's always room to improve. But still, that does give you an answer along the way, and maybe a final project with, you know, a university credit at the end, that might not work. But I think, you know, as we all explore this space, we'll find answers that do work. And I'll have to leave it at that, because the other thing fell out of my head. Any other questions here? Yes, in the back.
Yeah, the open course model for the platform is really great, but were you able to take the content and make that open also? And if so, did you have a lot of legal hurdles to deal with the university to basically contribute your time and other staff time and the faculty time to the common good?
Sure. So I can answer from Google's perspective is we are, as I noted, opening up our accessibility course under the Creative Commons. So, you know, if you create a course with that in mind, you can do so carefully. I think every university and situation would have a different answer, so I don't know what Indiana's plans is for opening up the content.
As far as opening up the content, I'm not really sure I can address that, but I can tell you that our case was a little bit unique in that Dr. Borner runs a research center, so she has a fair amount of autonomy in terms of what she can do with the research center. So that made things a little bit easier. We were able to kind of run it as CNS, not directly as Indiana University. Anyone who wants to take the course and view the content obviously can. In terms of reusing the content, I'm not really sure. I don't know if we've actually addressed that question yet, so that's definitely something we'll have to think about in the future.
But again, this is one of the benefits of an open platform that the university might control or an institution, is to the extent that institutions have different answers to that question, they can impose their own policies. You know, the tool won't tell you what to do. The tool will allow you to do whatever you desire to do. All right. Thank you all so much. It's really exciting to be participating in this. And again, I encourage you each to launch an experiment. Thank you.